Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Open Mic Session. Today's topic is WebSphere Data Power Appliances, Configuration, and Troubleshooting. My name is Joseph Lam, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's Open Mic session, we will start off by introducing to you our panel of experts for the day. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to today's topic. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that were pre-submitted to us through email. Then, we will open the lines for live Q&A period. Finally, the session will end with a summary of the Open Mic session. Moving on to slide number 3. At this time, I would like to introduce you to our panel of experts for today's call. Our panel consists of Alote Pepple, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hi, this is Moses. Yeah, so I've been with Data Power for about 3 years now. I specialize in XML stylesheet processing, typical, along with web service proxy setups, also FTP and ODBC configurations.
Thank you, Moses. Next, we have Jesse Shi, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hi, my name is Jesse Shi. I'm working in IBM in the Data Power Level 2 Support Team for 2 years. My expertise are WTX, FTP, ODBC, and XML management interface.
Thank you, Jesse. Then we have Paul McGanney, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Good morning, everyone. This is Paul McGanney. I've been with IBM 21 years, and I've been working in the Data Power arena for 2.5 years, and my specialties are FTP and ODBC, and I have involvement with the web service proxy and MQ.
Thank you, Paul. Next, we have Dominic Mikkel, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hi, this is Dominic McCauley. I've been an L2 support engineer with IBM for the past 2 years. I specialize mostly in the web service proxy, but I also handle a variety of others, such as MQ, the web application firewall, and as well as handling a majority of memory-related issues.
Thank you, Dominic. And we have Carol Mueller, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hi, this is Carol Miller. I've worked for IBM for about 11 years and for Data Power for 2.5. I specialize in FTP, ODBC, and memory issues.
Thank you, Carol. Next, we have Andrew Schumering, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hey, this is Andrew Schumering. I've been with IBM for about 5 years and with Data Power for about 1.5 years. I mostly specialize in TCP/IP networks and SSL security.
Thank you, Andrew. And finally, we have Alfred Williamson, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hello. My name is also go by Trey. I've been working Data Power support as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Trey. Before we get to the question and answer period, our panel of experts would like to give you a technical overview of the topic. Moving on to slide number 4, and please go ahead, Jesse.
IBM WebSphere Data Power is an appliance for processing XML messages as well as end-to-end latency message transformation. The Data Power appliance touches a wide range of technology components such as MQ, ODBC, typical, TAM, JNS, NFS, FTP, HTTP. Slide number 5, please. Today, in this open mic session, we will answer and explain some common configuration and troubleshooting questions, such as FTP, Web Service Policy, SQL Data Source, and some network troubleshooting. And with the comprehensive breadth that the appliance provides, you will find their power is highly configurable. In addition, there are more areas that could need further diagnosis and troubleshooting. Okay, let's start our first question, slide number 6.
Okay, this is Paul Magani. Question 1 is, can we differentiate between the various data power FTP configurations? And Joseph, can you please go to slide number 7? From a front-end perspective, and specifically for the data power services, which, like our multi-protocol gateway or web service proxy, there are several FTP components that can be deployed. They are as follows. We have an FTP polar front-side handler, an FTP server front-side handler, and an SFTP server front-side handler. And coming in the next major release of the firmware, tentatively scheduled for the end of this month, we will have an SFTP polar front-side handler. Now, the FTP polar front-side handler is a component where you can configure the directory on the FTP server that is to be polled and checked for files. You would configure it for a file matching pattern, for example, perhaps all .txt files. You would then specify a polling interval. So, for example, every minute you want to poll this directory. So you would specify 60,000 milliseconds for the delay between polls, and that's a field in polar front-side handler configured page. Files will then get picked up and then execute through the appropriate processing policy rule. Now, the FTP server and the SFTP server front-side handler is just basically where the appliance is acting as an FTP server, one being SSH and the other being non-SSH. The FTP server's IP address would be that of the data powered device. The user ID would be a configured user ID account on the device. There are also a number of fields that can be configured on both of these types of front ends, and I invite you to check them out at your convenience. Now, I also wanted to mention the XML firewall. The XML firewall can use the FTP protocol as well, but it would be more of setting like the back end to an FTP URL statically or dynamically via style sheet in a processing policy rule. And then it's possible to have that style sheet that uses the data power URL function, a URL open function, where we could specify an FTP URL. With that said, the XML firewall is still limited to its front-end components being an HTTP or HTTPS front-side handler. Joseph, can we please move to slide number 8? Okay, let's briefly discuss the XML manager user agent configuration, specifically narrowing in on the user agent. The tabs that I exploit the most are the basic auth policy and the FTP client policies tab. For example, if we have a back-end FTP URL configured, we would want to somehow associate the user ID and password with that FTP URL so we can like either get or put files to that location. We would use the basic auth policy tab and first giving a matching URL pattern that would match the FTP back-end and then specify the user ID and password for that URL. You know, where we know a configured user ID password on the FTP server exists. Now, what if our backend is FTP over SSL? In other words, FTPS. How would we do that? And this is where the FTP client policies tab comes into play. Again, we would specify a matching URL expression for the backend, and we can then select from the encrypt command connection dropdown whether we want to request or require TLS authentication. Also, we have other configurable fields of this tab where we could specify things such as active or passive mode. On slide 7, I did mention that like we can specify a back-end FTP URL statically or dynamically. To do so statically, we would just put the FTP URL into the back-end URL space on the web service proxy task template. To do this dynamically, we would set the type to dynamic back-end, and then in the style sheet, specify the data power service variable called var service routing URL to that back end. And then also, as mentioned in the last slide, we can employ the URL open data power extension function. In this slide, this is just an excerpt from our style sheet that is helping us retrieve a list of files at that specified URL location. And then lastly, I wanted to direct your attention to that URL at the bottom of slide 8. Last year, the data power support team gave a WSTE presentation on FTP use case scenarios as seen in the field. And this package has a wealth of information, and it's, again, scenarios which have been repeatedly seen by other customers, and also we have in that package the solutions. The package is a PowerPoint file, and there's some, if my memory serves me correctly, I think there's like some 60 to 70 foils. But check that out when you can. Joseph, can we move to slide number 9, please? And at this time, I'd like to hand off question number 2 to my colleague, Carol Miller.
Thanks, Paul. Question number 2 we got was, what are the key RAS aids that can be used in troubleshooting the data power appliances? If I can have slide 10. RAS stands for reliability, availability, and serviceability. And there were significant advances in all these in starting with firmware version 3. There's a set of diagnostic commands that generates useful debug information, particularly for our data power level 3 engineers. The set tracing on memory generates ND leak data, or memory tracings, that can be decoded by data power to show us which functions are using memory and how much they're using. If you have an NFS mount set up, you can do a full report with the show memory report command and send that to us if you're having memory problems. If you don't have an NFS mount or are having problems setting that up, you can also get the top memory users by issuing the show memory live command. There's also a diagnosis on port spin, which can track network connection issues. The URL that I have listed there with in blue is a tech note that gives you directions for NVLeak setup, and it's quite detailed and should answer most of the questions that you would have if you're trying to send us memory diagnostic information. There are a host of new commands that were added in 3.7.2. Once you go into diagnostic mode and in the CLI, they include show connections, show failure info, show handles, show memory, and show task maps, which almost all of these are debug information that's useful to us and to the development engineers, not so much to customers for doing their own diagnosis, but they definitely help us figure out what problems are. Joseph, can I have slide 11, please? There will be additional error report features coming out in the next major version, which, as Paul said, is tentatively scheduled for the end of the month. New 3.8.1 error reports won't be restricted to data power's temporary directory, where they could get lost in a crash. Error reports can be sent to an FTP or NFS or SMTP location where they will be preserved in a crash. Packet captures will be more sophisticated in the next version, where they can be filtered by IP address, by MAC address, or port, so that you don't have to capture packet capture information that you're not interested in. You can home in on the exact elements that you want to capture. First failure data capture feature will allow for an always-on packet capture option, and the packet captures can be compressed, can be added to an error report, and optionally stored off the box like an error report. Now I want to hand off to Dominic and slide 12.
Thanks, Carol. Hi, everyone. I'm Dominic McKelly again. So I'm here to give you a brief overview of the web server's proxy. If you could, please go to slide 13. So to begin, the web service proxy is available on all of Data Power's devices except the XA35. That's our accelerator device. So you can use it on our security integration, B2B, and the XM, which is our messaging appliance. So the web service proxy is simply a batch of WSDLs that can actually be tied together. And what's good about this is to save you redundancy. That's very important here. So when you first create your web service proxy, you'll start out with just creating the name of it, and it'll have you upload your first WSDL. After that, you'll be able to include as many WSDLs as you'd like. And these can be retrieved from a variety of methods, either being locally on the file system, or you can also remotely gather it through HTTP or HTTPS. And we also have support for UDDI and WSRR. Under the WSDL tab, as I mentioned, you know, there are the protocols that you would obtain at the WSDL, and you also are able to set the backend here. You can decide whether you would like this to be statically or dynamically set. You also are able to set multiple front-side handlers that are tied to the same WSDL, and these can be shared between multiple WSDLs. So there's a lot of configuration available here. To move on to the SLM tab, this is a feature to allow you to pretty much limit and control the WSDLs. You don't want your services to have free reign over devices. You want to set policies that are enforced that either restrict or notify an administrator, say, that you have too many messages going through a service, whether this be a denial of service attack or simply you are just receiving a larger load. You know, you may have a quarterly season that has taken place. So the SLM is very important, as you can set up statements that apply to certain messages or a certain WSDL. And the SLM schedules also allow you to define time during the day that it applies. To move on to the services tab, this is a very simple tab. This is simply a feature that allows you to do a simple click to publish to UDDI. So if you have WSDLs that are on data power and you would like to put those on your UDDI server, this tab will allow you to do it with just a few clicks. The policy tab is very important, as this is where you can set up all your transformations, AAA, etc. And what's really great about this is you can start out at a different set of levels. Your first level is actually the base service. So you have the web service proxy, and this has its own request and response rule. And what this thing is that I can have five different WSDLs, and they can all apply to this same request and response if I'd like. But it's not limited to that, because we can also break down from when it retrieves the WSDL into the proxy, WSDL, port, and port operation levels. So if you have two different operations, say add or subtract, obviously these may need to do different things, whether it be a transformation or maybe they have their own AAA. You can actually define these policies without them, you know, interrupting each other, whereas they... the operation for add could do a transformation, and the operation for subtract maybe only needs to handle AAA. So that's very important to have. The proxy settings tab is very similar to the multi-protocol gateway and the XML firewall. There is a lot of features where you can set, as I mentioned, service level, AAA, decryption, SSL, etc. And these are applied throughout the entire web service and all the WSDLs inside. The Advanced Proxy Settings tab is also, as the Proxy Settings tab, it allows you to set connection values such as enabling persistent connections and things of that nature. You can move on to slide 14, please. And these are some additional tabs. The Headers and Parameters tab is pretty familiar for those who have used the Multi-Protocol Gateway or the XML Firewall. This is just a method for you to manipulate the headers, for example, HTTP headers, in messages being sent to the backend. The WS addressing tab is pretty common for users that would like it. Features on here are, as I mentioned on the presentation, you can either do traditional to WS addressing to traditional, or WS addressing and straight across. The WS Reliable Messaging tab, this is a very complicated feature. It allows you to set a lot of rules on data power of how it's going to work with backends. It's kind of like dynamically setting backends, but it's more specific to the rules. I would highly suggest looking at the Web Service Proxy Developer's Guide if you're looking into reliable messaging, because there's a lot to cover there, and we have some great documentation to go over that. Finally, the XML Threat Protection tab is very important. This is a great feature on data power, whereas we can set limitations, you know, denial of service, SQL injection filters, dictionary attacks, etc. And it's nice because this is all through the web GUI, and it's all simple clicks and setting a few values. If you can move on to slide 15, please. So I just wanted to give some other suggestions to those out there. There are some features that might not be as straightforward as you'd expect. DataPower does have a feature where on the front-side handlers you can publish the WSDL, and let's say you have remote clients that actually need the web service definitions, and you can actually allow DataPower to publish that externally, and the clients can retrieve that. All you have to do is have the GET attribute enabled on the front-side handler. And you can also go back to the policy tab, and that will actually allow you to disable parts of the web service definition. If you feel that the client does not need that information, you can omit parts of the published WSDL. I skipped over this by accident, but, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you can utilize multiple front-side handlers, and they can also be tied to each other. So obviously it can get a little complex, but if you have the need for multiple front-side handlers to a specific WSDL or multiple WSDLs, you can do that. I would highly suggest looking at the Web Service Proxy Developer's Guide, because the Web Service Proxy is very complex. There is a lot available to the user. It's available at the link that's provided. Just simply click on a device that is not in the XA35 series, and you should have that available to you in a PDF format. I would like to pass the presentation on to Trey, who will be handling network troubleshooting, please.
Hello, folks. Since DataPower is a powerful network device, what are some of the best ways to troubleshoot networking issues? Go to slide 17. The main point, and I cannot stress this enough, is keep it simple. Don't make it a complex issue. Start off basically, just start with your routing table. Then you know the destination you're trying to connect to. If the device fails to connect, take it to any destination, whether it be LDAP, MQ, HTTP, FTP. Regardless of the protocol, it's just a destination, and it's got to work over a TCP connection. So start with basic routing. If the device fails to connect, take a look at the routing table. See which routes will be used to reach the destination. Make sure you do not have multiple potential routes for packets leaving the device. One of those routes may not be valid for the traffic. Quite simply, if you've got more than one network interface configured, there's a good chance you could have conflicting routes. When in doubt, use a 32-bit NetMask static route to force traffic over the expected interface. If you want traffic going to your LDAP server to go over ETH0, let's create a static route, use a 32-bit NetMask to be as specific as possible. Force the traffic to go over that interface. Make sure you do not have a half-duplex link on that interface. Very common issue. We see, I see once every week, if not every other week here in DataPower support, a half-duplex link can and will result in packet loss. When all else fails, a packet trace is your best friend to help you. If we would go to slide 18. All right. Never change the general network settings. I can't emphasize this enough either. Just like keep it simple, try not to change the general network settings on the device. There's some very powerful settings that allow you to completely rewrite the rules of packet routing and handling. So take a look at the debug log. I'm sure everybody on here is familiar with it. Use the system's default log. Take a look at a transaction. A lot of network failures are simply network errors in response to an upper layer protocol failure, such as HTTP or MQ. If you ever have an MQ, a queue manager go down for some reason, such as a reset, there's a chance you could wind up with a network error on back interface, which was really due to an outage or a reset connection coming from the MQ server. So always keep in mind that upper layer protocol can influence and impact those network errors. If you're getting network, one small tip is if you are getting random network errors for an HTTP service, very helpful thing would be to try disabling persistent connections. See if that prevents the errors or changes the behavior in any way. That can certainly save a lot of time. I believe slide 19. All right, and just a couple more points. Keep in mind that a network interface or port, whatever you like to call it, should be used per network segment or subnet. Rarely ever has an interface been the source of congestion. The reason I bring this up is quite simply, if you have all four network interfaces on the same subnet or three, it can cause some misconfiguration, some misunderstanding as far as network configuration can go. You don't want interface 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4 all connected to the same subnet if you do not have to have it. And quite as I was saying, the ports themselves, I've rarely ever seen them be a bottleneck in flow. So always try to use gigabit links where possible. Faster the device can get the data moving, the better. I believe that's it, and I'll pass over to question 5 now.
Hi, this is Moses, slide 20, please, and I'll be handling question 5. Question goes, can you please explain the SQL data source object in data power and how it is used? Slide 21, please. So the SQL data source is a license feature, so you need the SQL ODBC license in order for you to be able to use the object. And one thing to note is that it's not available on every appliance. So the DataPower XI50, which is the integration device, has it, but you have to purchase that when you're buying a device. The DataPower XB60, which is the B2B device, comes with it by default. And the DataPower XM70, the LLM device, that also you have to purchase the license. So once you create the object, that will allow you to be able to create establish connections to your database instance on a remote database server. And with this object, you can also specify optional configuration parameters. Those have to be valid based on the database that you're using. Slide 22, please. When you create the SQL data source object, what can you do with it? Once again, you use the object to connect to the database service and perform operations on that end. The current support as of the 3.8.0 firmware is the DB2, and support is up to 9.5. Microsoft SQL Server currently has support up to 2008. We have Oracle, support is up to 11G, and Sybase for that support is also up to 15. So once you create the database, the SQL data source object, and you've been able to connect to the database, you can perform some, you know, database operations, and these include selecting records from the database or inserting new records into it. You can also execute some stored procedures, and you know, these are just a few things that you can do. Also, in order for you to use it, that is once you've created the object, you can use it in your processing policy. And in the processing policy, there's the SQL action that you can use. So from the configuration screen for your processing rule, you can grab the SQL action, and from there you can specify which data source object you want to use. If you're interested in doing this in a more custom way, you can use a style sheet, and the data power has a function called the dpsqlexecute function, and with that function you can specify the source, which will be the SQL data source object of interest or to use. Then you can specify the statement that you want to, or the operation that you want to execute. And that's it. So can we please have slide 23, and Andrew will handle question 6, please.
Hi, all. This is Andrew Simmering. My question was, how does DataPower employ secure connections with its various services? Can we go to slide 24, please? DataPower uses a reusable object called the SSL proxy profile, which stores the certificates, keys, and any configuration options needed. It can be set to be used in all common SSL configurations, such as one-way or two-way authentication, in both the client and server roles. It can also be implemented in almost all services, front-side or back-side, including XSL inline services, such as URL open. It can also be used for SSL proxy service for simple encryption-decryption when data processing is not needed. Can we go to slide 25, please? Okay, this is just an overall view of how the hierarchy of objects work. The main thing here is the SSL proxy service, proxy profile service, and you have the other objects inside of that. Each object, such as crypto profiles, ID creds, and val creds, are completely reusable in different other objects. You can see how each nested object contains other reusable objects. This example shows a proxy profile that uses two crypto profiles, but a proxy profile can just as easily use the same crypto profile for both the forward and reverse directions, provided all the needed information for each respective type of crypto profile is present. Alternatively, a single crypto profile can also be used across multiple SSL proxy profiles. These are just a few examples of how you can reuse the different objects throughout the different SSL crypto objects and proxy profile services. I think now we're going to pass it over to Carol for slide 26.
Hi, this is Carol again. Question 7 was rather lengthy, but I'll read the first part and then I'll try to summarize. We've had difficulty getting developers or power users consistent access to their domains between the GUI and CLI. What's the best way to do that using onboard users and groups? For example, how would we set up permissions to allow this access via the CLI and GUI? And then they've got some sample users and some sample domains, and they want to match those users to certain of the domains, but not all. Can I have slide 27? The way I went about this was I created, in order to create a domain and its dedicated user, I started out in each case by creating the user and then restricting that user to a particular domain during the user creation. You can select that as an option. Data Power will then create that domain as a part of the same user creation process, and it also creates a user group dedicated to that new domain. When I created user Mary Jo, I just created a new user restricted to new domain, Mary domain. And then once that user was created, I went in and edited the Mary domain user group to include the other domain that the questioner wanted to use. Can I go to slide 28 and then maybe come back to this one? Once the Mary user was created, there's also a Mary domain user group, and I went in and saw the configuration for that user group down at the field that says access profile. It says Mary domain and access equals RWADX. And in order to add the Jo domain and give Mary read access, I just typed in the field below, following the pattern for the Mary domain. I typed it in for the Jo domain and gave her just access equals read instead of all the other access that she had. Can I go back to slide 27? Thank you. There was also a question about user Bobby Jo and giving him access to the Bobby and Jo domains. And in that case, again, I created user Bobby Jo, restricted him to the Bobby Jo domain, the Bobby domain, rather, sorry. And that gave him all permissions in that new domain. Then I went to the user group that was created, the Bobby Jo user group, and added again permissions for the Jo domain, this time giving him read, write, add, delete, and execute. To create a new user that's a local admin, you just create a new user and then choose privileged user from the drop-down, and that gives the person admin access. I think that one of the main parts of the question was, how do we give the person CLI permission to match their web GUI permission? And that is not obvious because it doesn't show up in any of the user or user group configurations, but there is a separate page called Configure RBM Settings for role-based management. And once you select that configuration, there's a tab called Enforce RBM on CLI. You set that to on. And then your CLI permissions should match up with your web GUI permissions. can I have, real quickly, slide 28 and then 29. Yeah, this just shows how to configure a user group to add additional domains. And then slide 29, please. This shows you the field that you need to select in order to match up the CLI permissions with the Web GUI permissions. Slide 30. There was a second part to question 7 where Mary Jo, who had restricted permissions, they want to let her do some troubleshooting. How can she add diagnostic mode and run flash commands and do troubleshooting? And the answer in this case would be to modify her user group again, adding CLI command groups for diag and flash. And those are available just on a drop-down on the CLI command group tab. We'd also recommend that she be given access to the default domain because in order to initiate NVLeak logging, a reboot is required to the device. So better to give that person extra permissions. Can I have the next slide, please? This is the user group CLI command groups tab that shows how you add flash and diagnostic permissions to Mary Jo. I think that's the end of my presentation. I think I'm going to hand it back to Joseph for slide 32.
Thank you, Carol. And thank you to our panel of experts for answering the pre-submitted questions. At this point in time, Kelly, we would like to open the lines for live Q&A period.
Our first question comes from Mesh Shankaran. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. This is in the same lines of what you just presented. Want to know if a user can belong, let's say we are having our group set up in LDAP and we're going via LDAP to fetch the groups to authenticate the user towards a domain. If the user belongs to more than one group, will there be any problems? Or let's say that this user, Mary Jo, needs access to two separate domains, and domain one, in order to get access to that, she has to belong to an LDAP group called domain one. And for domain two, an LDAP group for domain two. So we add Mary Jo's ID in LDAP. We add the two groups. Will that work?
I believe that the problem that you're going to run into with that is within the device, when you configure RBM using LDAP, you're going to have to create a custom map file to essentially map that user, that valid LDAP user, to some access profile. One of Carol's slides was showing the slide 28. It was showing a sample of several access profiles. The key thing there is going to be mapping that user to the appropriate access profiles. And that, honestly, in your case, it's I can't say there's going to be a simple way to do it other than you're going to have to do a little bit of trial and error to narrow it down and to get it working.
The last time we tried it was on a very old version of the firmware, and when the firmware went out and when it found more than one group, it threw an error saying, hey, this user belongs to more than one group. I can't handle this. Regardless of the profiles that we set on our end, right at the LDAP call, it failed.
Yeah, you're correct. There used to be a limitation of one group. I'm not sure if that's still the case, though. We would need to check that further.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Harish Akadi. Your line is open.
If there is a parser in the response of the backend service, is there any way to capture that message? Because it's not even entering into the multi-probe, so that's why we are getting some SOAP errors, SOAP parse errors. So is there any way to capture that message?
I don't want to answer the question. Anyone else on here like to answer? The easiest way I can answer that question, honestly, is you're correct. If the message doesn't enter into multi-step, if it fails on parsing, it is incomplete. The only two methods you've really got are to use the file capture method through the troubleshooting panel or through the packet capture.
Because I can disable that into a non-SOAP message, but it's, the problem is in production, so that's why.
Okay.
So it's not the problem is not creating in lower environments, but in the production. So that's why, is there any way that I can capture only that message? If something is failed at parse level, can I capture that only message into a file or some NFS static mount or somewhere? That's what my question is.
I understand. And right now, there's no method that I'm aware of to do that for intermittent parsing failures.
Mm-hmm.
You literally have to be prepared and capture it.
Yeah. I mean, because this problem is in production, I cannot capture all the messages.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Unless you know that it's, unless you have a good idea that it's going to happen and you can prepare to capture it, there is no other way to have a sort of flight recorder running in the current firmware versions.
Yeah, thank you, Megan.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Chuck Chang. Your line is open.
I have several questions about security. One thing is that when I integrate data power with LDAP, someone advised me that I should put a client certificate or a trusted certificate in LDAP. And how do I configure data power in order to verify a user certificate against certificates in LDAP? That's my first question.
You're doing client authentication against the LDAP server? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
You would just put that in the validation credential as part of the SSL proxy profile?
Yeah, it will want to externalize it. I mean, security team wants to have full control of all the SSL certificates.
They want a full control. Well, we also offer something called NSS security server that operates on ZOS to have external certificates that are pulled in. What do you mean by
NSS? Do you have that for open platform? Well, for Unix or for Windows, or we don't have anything here.
Yeah, as far as I know, it's only for ZOS.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the only option is to actually put that client certificate into data power, into the validation credential.
Okay.
And it'll validate it during the negotiation process.
Okay. That's my first question. The second question is, when data power get an authentication error, how do I configure it so return HTTP error code 401 instead of, you know, doing any SOAP of that?
Are you referring, I might need you to elaborate a little bit more on that question. Are you saying with any service type, multi-protocol gateway, firewall?
Yeah, either way, when I secure, for example, XML firewall or multi-protocol gateway and say that I want the client to come in using HTTPS, okay, and the client asks client to present his SSL certificate, his client certificate. Okay, if that fails, I want data power to throw back HTTP return code 401. Is that possible? Because at that moment, it's not going to my policy yet, so I have no control of the return code.
Right. So I think in this case, the SSL handshake will fail, and since that is actually the pre-processing step, there's currently no way to capture that and send back the 401. If it hits multi-step and you have a AAA policy, then the AAA policy will send back the 401, but that is for users that are not authenticated or authentication failed for them.
Yeah, but I'm not there yet. I can't, the code request hasn't reach my AAA yet.
Right, that's
right. Right.
It's rejected.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
the
right.
Pre-process. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know that handshake will fail before the data is even available. So
okay.
At that point, I don't think that there's a way to catch that error and then send back the
okay.
Appropriate message.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That's okay. So I understand the limitation. One thing I want to ask a question about FTP handler, just for my colleague. And I think the presentation says SFTP polar front end handler is a new feature. Is it available yet? Or if it is, in what firmware level?
It's not available yet, but it's going to, the SFTP polar front end handler is going to be available in the next major release of the firmware, which is tentatively scheduled at the end of this month.
At the end of this month.
Right.
So we have 3A1 right now, so probably 3A2, something like that.
Well, what do you have right now? 3A0?
3803. But
yeah, so
I think I can just release 3811.
Yeah. This is going to be 3A1.
3A1?
Yeah, you know what? I think the official release that gets generally available is going to be 3812.
Oh, 3812. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks.
Yep, you're welcome.
Our next question comes from Chris Wang. Your line is open.
I have a question on the FTP side, and I'm trying to use a data power URL open and trying to do the FTP put. But when I follow that the example document, very similar like the one has been presented today, but
yeah.
I always end up like a get, not put. I was wondering, is there any additional parameter I need to specify so the data power will interpret as a FTP put?
So the open URL, if there's like not any content around the open URL tag, the way data power perceives that is that it's a get. But if there's some content, okay, within the URL open element, then that's going to be a put. I mean, you could put the content there by having a variable point to some content and then have that variable within the URL open element.
Well, for instance, if my payload is being referenced by the input context, I can just reference the input context within the URL open statement?
Yes.
Okay. Could you tell me the exact syntax? I mean, followed by the URL open target equal that endpoint, and then followed by another, like a dollar sign, reference to the content?
Yeah. So it would be like the content that's coming in. I don't know. I think it's like a period. I'm not sure if it is which really references the content coming in. I think it's like a select equals. I'm not sure if it's a period. I don't know if any of my colleagues know.
Yeah. So to get the input context that came into your style sheet, you can just use the XSL value of and select equals period. That's correct.
Select period. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Moses.
Okay.
Yeah. So that will have to be inside your URL open call. Or if you like, you can retrieve that content and store it in a XSL variable and then, you know, use the XSL copy of. It depends on what type of content you're trying to push out. If it's XML and you want to push out or put the whole XML node set, then you want to use the XSL copy of. If it's just maybe like a string, maybe some string text, then you want to use the copy of, I mean, the select the XSL value of. So copy of will be for your node set to make sure that you copy the whole node set. And then the value of will be just if you're dealing with strings.
Okay. In my case, I just want to push a Word document.
Is that contained in your XML document or is it
just a regular Word? A Microsoft Word document. It's not XML file. It's a non-XML file.
It's non-XML?
It's not an XML file. It's just a Word document.
Okay. In this case, I think some of the factors will actually be the type of action you're using. If you're using the binary transform action or if you're using just the normal transform, usually when you're doing non-XML processing, then you want to use the binary transform action. From there, you can actually get access to the binary content. And in most cases, if you be dealing with binary content as well, we actually suggest BASIC64 encoding the data. So you can maybe XML wrap that, you know, Word document, BASIC64, encode that. And then you can use the URL open. You can specify the type of encoding. You can set it to BASIC64 and then use the XSL value of to access the XML element containing the BASIC64 data. And then before the data gets sent out, data power will BASIC64 decode it. So the end result will be the original document.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Have a good day.
And we do have one more question from Ramesh. Your line is open.
This is Ramesh from Walmart, and in today's presentation on the SQL data objects, I don't see support for Informix. Is it supported, or are we looking for the support down the road?
Not at this time. It's just MS SQL Server, DB2, Oracle, and Sybase, but Informix is just not supported at this time.
We did have another question come into queue from Scott Stignita. Your line is open.
Hi. In the last example where you were going through the users, when you created the user profile for Mary Jo on that screen, did you restrict the domains at all, or did you leave that blank? I don't recall.
The domains were set on slide 28.
Now I'm talking about the actual the user creation on the user tab. I think it was a previous screen, maybe, or maybe there wasn't a screenshot for that. I don't recall.
Scott, this is Carol. When I created each user, I restricted them to one domain during the user creation process.
Okay, through the GUI when it says, you know, select a domain or leave it empty to default
right.
to all domains. Okay.
Right. My understanding was they wanted them restricted, so that's where I chose it during the user creation process.
Okay. And the one you selected was one of the ones that later on become the entries in the user group?
Yes. They become entries in the user group automatically, is my
okay.
understanding.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
There are no further questions at this time.
Thank you, Kelly. And thank you, everyone, for your participation in the live Q&A period. At this point in time, I'm going to move on to slide number 34 and pass the presentation to Jesse for a summary of today's session.
In today's presentation, we have introduced some configurations in different components in some troubleshooting methods. Hope it helps you to configure data power easier, and if you have problems, you know how to help yourself to do troubleshooting and fire diagnosis. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse. At this time, we will conclude the OpenMind session.